Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is coming. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is coming. Don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be back. I spent a little time out west. Last night I had the good fortune to be invited to be the moderator on a panel discussion of the Koch Brothers film by Glenn Greenwald, Koch Brothers Exposed. And we've got a lot to talk about tonight, so I just want to let you know there's a better world of kind. Now, how do we know? Because there's good people every day doing the work. And we've got several of them on air tonight. We've got Professor Dr. Robert Watson from Lynn University. We've got Winnie Tang, who's president of the Asian American Federation, activist extraordinaire. Jose Suarez, communications director of SEIU. We've got Stratton Pollitzer, deputy director of Equality of Florida. We've got the illustrious Greg Pallast, the BBC economics and political reporter, who is doing a tremendous job showing Americans what's going on in our electoral system. But first, I want to depart from my normal opening and not go right into the news, because I want to ask you for your support to help a good friend of the show, Meredith Ackman. She's looking for support because she wants to go to the Victory Institute. And the only way she can go to the Victory Institute is if we support her. So I want you to go online to Facebook, and I want you to do a search for Meredith Ackman. She's currently president of NOW of Palm Beach, vice president of NOW for the state of Florida. This woman has worked tirelessly for human rights, for women's rights, and for LGBT rights. So I'm going to ask you, please, go online, search for Meredith Ackman, especially on Facebook, and click that you want to support her trip to the Victory Institute. She's a tremendous woman. She's been a tremendous guest here. She works really, really hard for human rights. And I'm asking you, please help her out. Let's send this gal to the Victory Institute. And what it is, it's training so that she can run for office and be really effective. This is somebody we need in our government, someone who we know is going to work for every human being out there. So do me a favor. Do Meredith a favor. Do yourself a favor. Do democracy a favor. And get out the vote for Meredith Ackman. As I said, currently vice president of NOW of Florida, president of NOW of Palm Beach. This is a woman who we want to see in American politics, so help her out. It starts the grassroots, my friends. You are the grassroots. And as I mentioned to the people last night at that town hall meeting when we watched the Koch brothers exposed, you're the vanguard. You're the people who are paying attention. You're the people who are keeping yourselves informed. You're the ones that have to do this. We're the ones who are going to make this a better world. And now to the news. Very interesting stories in addition to Hurricane Sandy bearing down on the East Coast. We'll see if all those Republicans and teabaggers are still want to see government stay off their backs and out of their pockets. Maybe, in fact, they'll notice that, you know what, when we all work together, we all go a lot further. Okay, a plan for hunting terrorists signals the U.S. intends to keep adding names to the kill list. Yes, over the past, the Obama administration has been secretly developing a new blueprint for pursuing terrorists, a next-generation targeting called Disposition Matrix. The matrix contains the names of terrorist suspects arrayed against an accounting of resources being marshaled to track them down, including sealed indictments, clandestine operations. U.S. officials said the database is designed to go beyond existing kill lists, yes, beyond the kill list, mapping plans for the disposition of suspects beyond the reaches of American drones. Though the matrix is a work in progress, the effort to create it reflects a reality setting in among the nation's counterterrorism ranks. The United States Convention wars are winding down, but the government expects to continue adding names to kill or capture lists. And, of course, they'll be storing them in black locations, in undisclosed locations. Among senior Obama officials There's a broad consensus that such operations are likely to be extended for at least another decade or more. Given the way Al-Qaeda continues to metastasize, some officials say, and no clear end is in sight. We can have war forever and ever. Women. Incredible. Okay. By the way, you can find additional notes on the show if you go to averyvoice.blogspot.com. The show notes, the news stories that I cover, are all posted there at Avery Voice, A-V-E-R-Y, averyvoice.blogspot.com. And also, by the way, if you go to our site, newmercurymedia.com /pnn.html, there's also an email there. You can send news to news@averyvoice.com, and we'll read those announcements as part of our community service. Okay, also coming up, Associated Press says that ex-CIA official Kirkow pleads guilty to leaking covert operative's identity to reporter. This is an extended coverage of the GAP client and former CIA official, torture whistleblower John Kirkow, who pled guilty yesterday in a plea deal to violating Intelligence Identities Protection Act. The majority of Kirkow's charges were dropped, including all Espionage Act charges. Kirkow was motivated to take the plea because of a desire to ensure that he could see his children grow up. Another one of those whistleblowers who the government doesn't seem to want to protect. Going on in terms of drone policy, hey, it should also be noted that U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan currently are not really about protecting civilians in the United States from terrorist attacks. In any event, U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan today are primarily an extension of the war in Afghanistan, targeting suspected militants believed to be planning an attack to attack U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Since the majority of Americans oppose the war in Afghanistan and want U.S. troops to be withdrawn from Afghanistan, this is a highly relevant political fact. U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan are being carried out in support of a war that most Americans oppose. Pretending that U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan are about protecting civilians in the United States when they're primarily about ending the unpopular war is therefore pretty significant deceit. Hey, when the U.S. troops are withdrawn from Afghanistan, as most Americans want, then there'll be no reason to use drone strikes to target militants in Pakistan who are trying to attack U.S. troops in Afghanistan, because there'll be no militants in Pakistan trying to attack U.S. troops in Afghanistan, because there'll be no U.S. troops in Afghanistan for them to attack. Another drone story. Oh, you'll be happy to hear this. Drone vote killers. If this year's presidential election comes down to electoral votes in Ohio, the deciding votes could be counted on electronic voting machines manufactured by a company, Hart InterCivic, with deep financial ties to the Omni family. Hart InterCivic is a majority owned by HIG Capital, which controls two of the five seats on Hart InterCivic, an investment fund with deep ties to Romney family and a Mitt Romney for president campaign. HIG Capital was founded by Tony Tamer, major bundler for the Romney campaign, and it's one of the largest partners of Solimir Capital, an investment firm funded by Tag Romney, and Spencer Zwick, Mitt Romney's chief fundraiser for the 2008 political campaign. This makes the Romney family part owner of the voting machine company, though its interest in HIG Capital, a 2007 study conducted by the Ohio Secretary of State shows that Hart InterCivic's touchscreen voting machines could be easily corrupted. Now there's a shocker for you. You see, it's not just an election at stake. It's our democracy at stake. It's your participation at stake. We've seen an across-the-board attack on voters' rights, the new Jim Crow, or Wando, if you will. There are many reasons to be very concerned. This is more than about just picking the lesser of two evils. The remarkable, unfathomable ignorance of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. More on this here. We'll actually have a clip of Debbie Wasserman Schultz denying that she knew anything about the kill list. Hey, news to her. And also, by the way, in the process of drowning government in a bathtub by lesser and lesser funds, poison control centers are on their way out, on the way of the dodo. Earlier this year, federal officials put their foot down. New Hampshire could no longer use federal preparation money to support its poison control efforts. The draft sent to state lawmakers scrambling to find extra funds so that New Hampshire residents would still have access to life-saving service without new money. Your callers to the Northern New England Poison Control Center would get a recording them to call 911 or go to an emergency room. Fortunately, New Hampshire officials found enough funds to keep the service up and running for state residents. However, they'll confront the same problem again next year's budget. Such are the ups and downs of funding. Nothing new to Karen Simone and her colleagues, but it's most definitely taking a toll. People seem to make the assertion the assumption that the poison control chemicals will always be there, said Simone, a clinical toxicologist and director of the Northern New England Poison Control Center, which serves Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. They said that any doctor or emergency room can handle it, and it's a shock when I say that your average ER doctor doesn't know how to handle these cases. Simone tells me that her poison control center used to have enough staff to help every caller in a more leisurely pace, answer every question without having to rush. But due to overall funding cuts, typical daytime staff has been cut from 3 or 4 people to 1 or 2, and callers have to triage themselves according to a phone tree. Occasionally, the center has to shut down its non-emergency line for hours at a time because it just doesn't have the capacity to handle every call. Previously, the center never had to shut down any of its phone lines, Simone said. The Northern New England Poison Control Center manages more than 66,000 calls from Maine through July 2010 and June 2010. More than 5,500 calls from New Hampshire between 2011 and March 11 from January to March, and more than 11,000 in Vermont from between March 11 and August 2011. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the news. I've got my first guest. I think we've got Professor Dr. Watson. Professor Dr. Watson, I presume.
Yes, elementary, my dear.
You know, you don't get a chance to say that every day, sir, so I hope you'll forgive my little bit of levity there.
That's fine. I could have worse names, I suppose, so that's fine.
Okay, great. Would you prefer Dr. Watson or Professor?
Robert's fine.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. I want to welcome you to the show, sir. There's so many things we can talk about. Let me ask you first. You're such a educated man in terms of American politics. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what American Studies means at Lynn University?
Okay, well, Lynn University, we're the ones who just hosted the third and final debate on October 22nd, which was exciting. We had 3,500 journalists and politicians on campus, and our American Studies program was in the thick of it. What we do in American Studies, we study American politics, American history, American culture and pop culture, American literature, geography. So it's a broad, multidisciplinary course of study that looks at America broad-based. Our graduates do things like they become school teachers, journalists, they go to law school. Some of them work for nonprofits, community organizers, work for government agencies. So it's a sort of a mix, I guess you could say, of political science and history, more traditional academic disciplines. I've run the program there for 6 years. I've been a professor for 2 years in schools around the country.
So let me ask you a nuts and bolts question. Obviously, you've done a lot of thinking about American politics, American electional systems. Would you say that our electoral debates are moving in a positive direction or a negative direction, if I could trouble you to make so simplistic an assessment?
Sure. Well, I would say the debates are a new thing. The very first presidential debate was not until 1948. It was a primary debate during the Republican primary on the eve of the Oregon primary. Mr. Stassen and Mr. Dewey, two Republicans, debated, and it's a horrible debate because it was based on one topic. And that one topic was Joe McCarthyism, communist mongering and fear mongering. So it's a low point. Then in the 1950s, there was a Democratic primary debate between Estes DeFalver and Adlai Stevenson. So the first general election televised presidential debate was not until 1960 between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. I would say the debates are better than they used to be. The reason being is because they were so new, and in 1964, 68, there were no presidential debates. Lyndon Johnson was so far ahead of Barry Goldwater in 64 that he said, "I've got nothing to gain and everything to lose," so he simply refused to debate him. Nixon refused to debate anyone in 68 and 72. So at least now, we have every 4 years, we have 3 presidential and 1 vice presidential debate. They're run by the Commission on Presidential Debates. So while there's clearly room for improvement, and while the moderators, I think, were only so-so this time around, at least we have 3 presidential debates each election cycle. So in the broad sense, I guess that's a step in the right direction.
Well, generously put, sir, generously put. Were you surprised that a debate on foreign policy was so narrowly framed?
Well, the idea was to have one debate on domestic policy. That was the first one. A town hall style debate is the second, and a foreign policy debate is the third one. But the best plans go awry. What happened was both candidates, especially Governor Romney, every chance they could, they pivoted back to the economy or domestic issues. The reason being is that public opinion polls show that the economy is issue number one. So the candidates wanted to appeal to their base, wanted to appeal to the public in terms of the issues that the public said was the most important. So unfortunately, we didn't have as rigorous a foreign policy discussion as we hopefully would have had. President Obama, however, did discuss several policy issues, I thought, reasonably substantively. And the president should, because on balance, his foreign policy and national security record by any measure, by any objective measure, is quite impressive. You know, we've re-engaged around the world in terms of treaties and being multilateralist rather than sort of cowboy do it, you know, go it alone like George W. Bush. We have, you know, oil exports are up. Middle East oil dependency is down. Osama bin Laden's been removed along with more senior al-Qaeda, more senior Taliban in 3 years than under 7 years under George W. Bush since the war began. So Obama spent a little bit more time, I think, on foreign policy than Mitt Romney, who is a governor. He clearly lacked the kind of foreign policy gravitas or credentials that the sitting president, the sitting commander-in-chief would have. But every chance the candidates got, especially Romney, as I said, they did in that third debate try to pivot back and talk about the economy, which is simply because that's what the polls are saying that people want to hear.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, and clearly they were. I will accept your terminology. They were certainly trying to return to an economic approach. It just seems that with so much of our economy, the topic in theory that issues related to the European economic situation, imports, exports. The Chinese relationship with the American economy, whether in a manufacturing vein or in a economic exchange front, there just seemed to me to be an awful lot that wasn't on the table. Discussions of Central and South America, African policy.
I agree.
Got a new African command, and yet nothing mentioned. Let me turn back to the debate. I won't say tactics, but I will say the debate mechanism itself. You know, clearly you're a person that thinks a lot about politics. You think a lot about the give and take of politics. Now, in this debate, there was some criticism because the moderator pointed out or was called upon to point out that Mr. Romney once again strayed off of what those of us who call reality. And he was truthed, if you will, by Ms. Crowley. What do you think about moderators? And I guess in a sense, the press in general is part of the press's responsibility to say you're lying, or is it as too often the case the press just says this guy said this, you decide. Many Americans aren't informed enough to make a logical or an informed decision on that. What's your take on that?
Well, I think you're spot on. And before I answer that directly, let me just say I agree completely with the previous comment that so many important foreign policy issues that weren't discussed, that it's a shame. And relatedly, it's hard to separate domestic policy from foreign policy, whether it's the trade deficit or whether it's climate change or immigration or, as you correctly noted, the situation in Europe, Greece, Spain, and so forth and so on. There should have been far more time to put that. But I think you raised a very good question. I had no problem with Candy Crowley pointing out the facts. Now, think about it. We've gotten so bad, we've gotten so far gone, that if a journalist simply states the fact, she's being bitterly criticized by Fox News and people on the right. Now, You know, there's a school of journalism that suggests that journalists have no business interjecting their own views and perspectives into a situation. I can accept that, that they need to just report the facts and allow the public to make a decision. However, when that type of journalism becomes so passive that you can have someone getting up there, and remember, through 22 Republican debates, Mitt Romney said the first thing he wants to do is gut day one every facet of Obama's health care, and then when asked about it, he denies it and says he wants to make sure that kids with pre-existing conditions are covered. College students are allowed to stay on their plan until they're 26, and he basically picks off every facet of Obama's health care plan. That's a 180-degree flip just from the last Republican primary debate until this particular debate. We even saw Governor Romney switching his position from the first debate to the second debate. So if we have gotten so far gone that we're saying journalism's only job is to very dryly and neutrally lay a story out there and let the people do with it as they will, you know, I think that's problematic, because a journalist has the responsibility, as does the moderator, to point out the facts. Now, there was no way that Candy Crowley was siding with one person or another, and she wasn't repeatedly pummeling Romney, nor was she giving Obama 10 minutes and then wouldn't let Romney speak. She was fair, objective. She followed the rules that were agreed upon, but then she simply pointed out the fact when the two candidates were at an impasse. Romney said that's not true. Obama said it was true. Romney said it wasn't true. Obama said it was true. And we were coming up with an easily discernible point, and that was, did the president call or label what happened in Benghazi in Libya a terrorist incident? And Obama said, look, if you look at the transcript, the day after this occurred in the Rose Garden, I said these terrorists will be brought to justice. And so that, it's not that it was a value-laden statement where if the journalist weighs in, she, you know, shows her bias or her own bias. She simply pointed out the fact that the president said a word that he said during a speech. So it's absolutely absurd that she caught so much grief over this comment. And I think, you know, on one hand, the moderator needs to kind of get out of the way and let the folks have a discussion or a debate. On the other hand, when they are refusing to answer the question, or number two, they're flipping their position or misleading the public, or number three, there's a debate as to whether somebody said something or didn't say something, I think it's the moderators, I think it's their responsibility to step in and, for crying out loud, moderate the debate. So this is just the way that the Republicans knew that Romney lost the second debate, and they were trying to, as they oftentimes do, shift the blame and blame a journalist rather than blame their candidate for either lie, getting the facts wrong. So it's a bait and switch, a duck and cover kind of a move, and I think you're right to bring it up.
Well, thanks. You know, there are so many people who, let's say, hold their opinions lightly and yet loudly, but I thought you were a person who's, you know, studies American politics professionally. And, of course, part of electoral politics is that give and take. And I wanted to get your assessment, and I thank you very much for that. Let me take you a little deeper afield into the American political scene and ask you about what I'm going to call a force in the American political process. The organization called ALEC, or the Legislative Exchange. I'm sure you're familiar with how much national legislation in state houses has come from this organization. I think it served a very special place in American political legislation, I guess, simply put. Do you have a take on the ALEC organization and what it has done to bring a series of legislative actions, literally in many states across the country?
Yeah, sure. Good question. Another fair question. Here's the thing. There are hundreds and hundreds of interest groups in this country. There are as many political action committees. There are as many think tanks around the country. You know, there's whole, you know, economies in Washington, D.C. that are built up around all these think tanks that are applying for government grants and government funds to do studies. And each one of these organizations puts forth a position to the Congress and says, we advocate A or we advocate B. And under the Bush years, there were a series of sort of pro-oil, anti-renewable energy organizations who were basically writing policy and giving it to the Bush-Cheney administration for them to adopt. Likewise, there were think tanks that were weighing in on what should happen in Iraq, what should happen in Afghanistan. So there's a long history of this. So what Alex has done, I think, is simply the latest in a long line of organizations that put forward what they believe to be good government measures and what others believe to be perhaps not so good government measures. What I think is interesting is in the 8 years of Bush-Cheney, we sort of saw this government by think tank, whereby so much of the day-to-day of developing policy and legislation was sort of subcontracted out or passed along to these conservative think tanks, and people weren't saying much about it. But then when Democrats look to a variety of organizations for good government or for input, then people are screaming foul ball or this is somehow new and unprecedented when it simply isn't the case. So I guess you could go back to that old adage, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And, you know, this is clearly not the first time this sort of thing has happened, and it won't be the last time such a thing has happened. But what we do need is we need fair treatment on both sides. It can't be applauded and permitted when one political party runs Washington, but when the other side does, it's somehow labeled as brand new and unprecedented, inappropriate. So I guess that's what I would say on that.
Thank you. Let me ask you a question, which to me is part and parcel of this whole ALEC agenda. We've seen over 37 states in this great country of ours suddenly discover the problem of illegal voting, and we've seen voting rights tightened and restrictions put on, and the slogan is, well, you want an honest vote, well, you won't want criminals and illegal aliens voting. And of course, those of us who pay attention notice that they really haven't found any of these people. They have a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. Do you think that voters' enfranchisement is in danger?
Well, I think that the quote-unquote voting reforms that have been tried in Pennsylvania, Florida, that are tried around the country, pushed by Republican governors and Republican legislatures, I think you're hard pressed to call them a reform. It's voter suppression any way you slice and dice it. Why? Of course, you, me, we all want to make sure that everybody votes, and we want to make sure that there's not voter fraud. However, if we were to sit and make a list of the 10 or 20 most important issues facing the country, there's no way voter fraud would even begin to make that list. Nor would it make a list if we made a list of the 10 most important issues regarding elections themselves, where we want, let's say, better designed ballots or campaign finance reform or nonpartisan supervisors of elections. We want new voting technology. We want whatever is on the list. It wouldn't even make the top 10 or top 20 there. There are so few documented incidents of voter fraud that they've raised a boogeyman that doesn't really exist. And another way to look at it is this. They have gone full bore. Some of these folks yelling voter fraud, voter fraud, they've gone full bore into promoting a whole series of measures that will do more to suppress people from voting than it will to catch these handful of people engaged in voter fraud. Relatedly, if you're serious about voter fraud and improving our election system, you ought to spend at least as much time promoting get out the vote, voter registration, and civic education programs. But what we see among several Republican governors and Republican legislatures that have been pushing this quote-unquote voter fraud, voter reform stuff, they've done virtually nothing to promote civic education, voter engagement, get out the vote, voter registration. So, if you're concerned about it, you should be concerned about the other parts just as well. And here in Florida, for example, we had a 14-day early voting period. And it helped to get more people out to vote 4 years ago. It helped to shorten the lines. It helped to make a more positive voting experience. So it worked all the way around. So what did the Republican governor and legislature do? They got rid of it. They cut 14 days down to 8. You know the old notion, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So it worked fantastically, but they gutted it. They cut it down to 8 days, and they spent more effort trying to catch some alleged, voting fraud incidents than they did promoting civic education. The other thing that just doesn't add up, so if you simply do the math, none of this adds up, is that if you're going to purge voter rolls, that is, you remove people's names from voter rolls. Let's say someone moved from Florida to Georgia years ago, but they didn't notify the elections office in Florida. Their name would still be there on the roll. So if the person hasn't voted several times, and if you send them mail and they don't respond, then you can purge their name from the list. But, textbook, day one in an undergraduate class on campaigns and elections, you do not purge during an election year. You purge in between. Well, they were trying to purge in the weeks leading up to an election, this summer here in Florida. So not only did they violate every notion of good government and common sense how to improve voting and crack down on voting fraud, I mean, they're trying to purge names from the list going into an election. And if you look at the names on the list, essentially, and I don't mean to sound flippant with this, I'm just trying to illustrate a point, but
basically, a
lot of the names on the list ended in a vowel, if you know what I mean. So they were trying to purge names that looked like immigrants' names or, not a WASPy name or a name that might be more inclined to vote Democratic. So if you do the math and you add this up, it's simply there is no major issue of voter fraud in the United States. It's like we need to do something about all the aliens from planet Zebulon arriving here on Earth. There are no aliens from planet Zebulon arriving here on Earth. There's so few incidents of voter fraud, it's ridiculous.
Let me ask you. I'm in complete agreement with you. But it seems to me what the question that needs to be asked is, why has the Justice Department seemingly acquiesced to this attack on voter enfranchisement? When the League of Women Voters shuts down a voter drive because of intimidation, that is a symptom of a very, very dangerous attack on the American right to vote. And I cannot understand why our Justice Department seems to be asleep at the switch. Is there a greater crime to democracy than preventing people from voting? I can't imagine it.
I agree with you. First off, it's not – I would agree that the Justice Department should have done more. But I would disagree that the Justice Department didn't do anything. They were working on this. However, I agree with you completely that they should have done more. Here in Florida, they were active in that they repeatedly butted heads with the governor of Florida and the Republican legislature. And as the governor and Republican legislature were demanding that the Justice Department release some kind of one list after another list, the Justice Department didn't do it. And then ultimately they did release a list that turned out to be very embarrassing for the governor, because all the alleged tens of thousands of names of all these illegals that were voting in Florida, when the list was examined, it turned out that there were just a handful of cases over many, many years. We're basically having about one case per year of voter fraud filed here in Florida, so it simply is not an issue. So the Justice Department was pushing back. However, they should have done more. And I agree with you that I think if you think about our history, we have spilt blood to get people to vote. From 1870, the 15th Amendment that allowed black men to vote, to 1920, the 19th Amendment allowing women to vote. I mean, it took people marching. It took years. It took struggle. It was a bitter, long road to equality. The 1965 Voting Rights Act, the effort to remove poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests in 1964. This has been a long and difficult journey to equality. And now that we're on the cusp of arriving to full equality, we're seeing one of the political parties in several states playing politics with our sacred right to vote. So I would agree completely with you that there's not much more that would be important than our basic right to vote. It's the underpinnings of a healthy democracy, and it is being messed with as we speak. And I think on November 6th, in a few states where this kind of nonsense has occurred, I think there's going to be a lower voter turnout than we otherwise should have had and would have had.
Well, they've been quite successful. Let me ask you one more difficult question before I throw you my concluding softball, sir, on the difficult list. You know, we've got a situation here where clearly the Republicans have been working for some time to disenfranchise voters, African-American voters, Hispanic voters, Muslim voters, transients, students, women, you know, you got the list. Then these same people that brought us this attack on voters registration also provided another interesting solution a few years back when they insisted that the improvement to improve our electoral system was to give us paperless, non-encrypted, non-transparent black box voting machines. As a historian who studied the American political system, was this an improvement in the American electoral system?
No, I don't think you can say that much that they have and attempted to do in recent years has helped the election system in any way. If anything, it's a grotesque step backwards, what they've done. Here in Florida, there was a strong effort pushed by then-Democratic Congressman Robert Wexler, and it has since been pushed by a number of other Democrats to try to at least get a paper trail for the touchscreen electronic voting machine. It turned out that some of these voting machines were fraudulent. Some of these voting machines were not. There were some questions about them. And if you don't have a paper trail to validate, I mean, how can you put your trust in the system? And if the public begins to doubt the viability of their election system, then that leads to a whole series of perceptual problems and a whole series of practical problems who don't turn out to vote. After the 2000 election, I think there was a grand opportunity for bipartisan support to move forward in a way with real election reform, but it was opposed by the Bush administration. And HAVA, which was the Help American Vote Act, did pass, but it was so watered down that it was little more than, you know, a window dressing for it was a Band-Aid on a cancerous wound, quite frankly. And it's a shame that we missed that golden opportunity to come together and promote real election reform in 2000. And, you know, we're still here. Florida, for example, we're on our third voting system since 2000. We had the old punch card, then we went to a touch screen, and now we're at this voting system where there's the beginning of an arrow and the end of an arrow pointed towards someone's name, and you have to color in the middle of the arrow. You think about it. That's technology circa about BC 1000. You know, there was a caveman that was getting a stone or a pickaxe and you know, carving an arrow in a rock somewhere. And this is the technology we're using. If you were to take the profession of law, a law firm, or a corporation, or an aerospace company, or the Pentagon, they are all pursuing the latest technology available to pursue excellence. And here in voting,
tablets for everyone.
Yeah, we're using BC 1000 technology. You have to connect two sides of an arrow. It's absolutely embarrassing. And yet all around the world, we're trying to promote voter reforms and democracy, and we're not even doing a good job of doing it here at home. It's quite a shame. So shame on those folks that are pushing all this nonsense and undercutting the funding of real election reform, better design ballots, better voting technology, more effort to register people to vote, more civic education, more efforts to get the public out to vote. You cannot name at all any efforts that let's say the Republican Party has been doing in the last couple of years that would even begin to meet any of those criteria. So it's when they're putting all their effort into prosecuting or trying to prevent one instance of voter fraud a year here in Florida or elsewhere around the country, but not doing anything about all those real intangible issues, it unmasks them for what they're doing, and it unmasks the effort for what it really is.
Well, thank you so much. Let me ask you one last question, if I may, sir. Robert, it's hard enough in this world to make a living, to raise your family, and I think it takes a special kind of individual who says, in addition to that, I'm going to take on educating, I'm going to take on helping my community. Could you tell me just a little bit about yourself and what brought you to a place where you wanted to be a teacher or you wanted to try to help contribute to the community beyond merely making a living for your family?
Well, thanks. Yeah, I've been a professor for 22 years. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I don't play the lottery, but if I did and I won it, I would still show up tomorrow the same way and teach my classes. I also, one of the things that I like most about being a professor allows me to have several jobs. I publish 34 books and a couple hundred scholarly articles and chapters and probably 1,000 newspaper columns in my time. And almost all of that is free, just the public service. I also go to, for about 25 years now, ever since I was getting my PhD, I go to area K-12 schools and tell them about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or the Revolution or the Civil War, just to try to promote history education and civic education. And frankly, I consider it to be a real honor to be able to do that and a way to get involved in my community. And I'm just delighted that I get the opportunity to do that. In some ways, I can't believe that I get paid for what I do, which is talk about history and try to get my students engaged and go out into the community. I do maybe 3 town halls or public lectures a week in the community for groups of a couple hundred folks in the community, whether it's at libraries or civic associations or synagogues or wherever it is. So I try to walk the talk. If I tell my students to get involved and they don't see me out in the community, then the message is going to ring hollow. So there's probably not a day that I'm either writing or out in the community or working to promote making this a better place, making our country better, and trying to promote civic history awareness and a sense of involvement. So, yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about that.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on, sir. I'd love to have you back again. Thanks so much for your insight.
Yeah, I'd love to be back. It'd be my pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity. Congratulations with the show.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a wonderful interview with Dr. Robert Watson of Lynn University. He told us a little bit about the debate experience and then some of the issues we discussed about American politics. I'm going to play you a little comment. This was taped by RTTV, discussion with Debbie Wasserman Schultz about the American foreign policy. Let me play this while we're waiting for our next guest.
Well, I'm looking forward to President Obama, continuing to clearly and decisively lay out his case for the American people. He'll talk about the importance of restoring our diplomatic reputation across the globe, which he's been able to successfully do.
Okay, well, how does Obama justify his flip-flop on the National Defense Authorization Act, especially the indefinite detention provision, which he said he never wanted, but he's now, the administration is appealing our order?
I didn't hear that as a subject of the debate tonight.
What's your bottom line on the debate tonight?
The bottom line on the debate tonight was I think President Obama had a decisive victory.
President Romney becomes president. He's going to inherit President Barack Obama's secret kill list. This is going to be debated. How do you think Romney will handle this kill list, and are you comfortable with him having a kill list?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Obama has a secret kill list, which he has used to assassinate different people all over the world.
I'm happy to answer any serious questions.
Why is that not serious?
Because I have no idea what you're talking about.
Of course you don't.
And there we go. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has no idea what he was referring to when he talked about the kill list. Of course, over in Pakistan, underneath the drone war, they sort of do. Okay, yeah, that's that list that the president and himself get to review and decide what due process of justice is. While we're waiting for Ms. Tang to call us up, let's go ahead and do another news story. We've got several here worthy of your time consideration. It seems that Iraq has another long-term benefit besides the improved democracy we brought them. Severe birth defects soar in post-war Iraq. A new study confirms what many Iraqi doctors have been saying for years. There is virtually an epidemic of rare congenital birth defects in cities that suffered extensive bombing, artillery, and small arms fire in the U.S.-led attack and occupation of their country. The hardest hit appears to be Fallujah, a city in central Iraq, and Basra in the south. A record showed that the total number of birth defects observed by medical staff at Al-Basra Maternity Hospital more than doubled between 2003 and 2009. In Fallujah, between 2007 and 2010, more than half the children born there have had some kind of birth defect, compared to less than 2% in 2000. Mogzan Savabestafani, a lead author in the latest study, published in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology, entitled Metal Contamination and an Epidemic of Congenital Birth Defects in Iraq Cities, reports in the case study of 56 Fallujah families, metal analysis of hair samples indicates contamination with two well-known neurotoxic metals, that is lead and mercury. IPS correspondent Julia Callis spoke with Savar Stefani about Iraq's health crisis and long-term consequences of exposure to metals released by bombs and munitions. We'll get back to that later. We've got the charming and talented president of the Asian American Federation of Florida, Organization of Chinese Americans, Ms. Winnie Tang. Good evening, Ms. Tang. How are you tonight?
Hi, good evening. Great fun. Great. Thank you.
How are you doing tonight, my dear?
Hello?
Yes, yes. I can hear you very well. So, Winnie,
okay.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Asian American Federation of South Florida, the Organization of Chinese Americans?
Okay. The first one, both of them is a nonprofit organization. And the Asian American Federation starting in 1984, and then it was the first about until 2009 is really focused in the South Florida area. And then during the census of 2009, and we be able to work with other Asian organizations in the state of Florida. So, and then also we chartered the organization as a statewide organization. Right now we have over 70 Asian American organizations from Miami all the way to Jacksonville and Tallahassee and also Pensacola, Orlando areas. And so our work is really to have a unified voices for the Asian community to share our issue and concern to the general public and everybody. And then Organization of Chinese American is a national organization, and since 1973, and the South Florida chapter was founded in 1987. So our work is almost equivalent to NAACP, is Asian American Civil Rights Organization, that we are advocating the social, economic, and political well-being for the Asian community throughout the whole United States.
I know you also have been involved in educational issues, child development, homeless reform, welfare reform. You have been a very busy individual, and also you do a lot of work with the Get Out the Vote program, right?
Right, because over the year, there's been really, have done a lot of chances to work with different organizations and groups, and then to really advocating the issues in the immigration, welfare, and education, and those economic, those areas. And then right now, and it's a very timely, it's a 2012, it's election year, and for the president. So our Asian American Federation also really partnered with receive funding from Asian American Justice Center and APIA Vote, and to mobilize the Asian community to do the voter registration and get out the vote to demonstrating our power to really what our voices can be heard.
And I know you also were involved with the census as well.
Yes, and because what happened, and also I've been able to also work with the two censuses, 2000 and the 2010. And be able to really work in the different community and be able to get the voice be heard. And this is the one thing we got the record high to really have about over from have a 71% of Asian population growth in Florida, comparing from 2010 to 2000. And we are right now nearly over 500,000 Asians living in the state of Florida. And in the 2000, we have about only 39 counties have recording a good amount of Asian population. And throughout the effort for everybody across the state, and we've received the record high number for the number. So right now we have a recording every single county in state of Florida. 67 of them also have Asian living there. And the higher number of Asian living is in Broward County and Duval County, Orange County, and then Miami-Dade County and Hillsborough County, those areas. And so for those one, that same thing right now when we look at the voting number, we also having the same setup as well, that the Bow County have a very high register Asian voters. And then and so as Orlando, Doral, and Hillsborough, and Miami-Dade County. So that's when we look at those numbers, a lot of time people been really overlooking the Asian because we are spreading out so wide from Miami to every place, not really seeing like the traditional Asian city like San Francisco, L.A. They have the, what you call it, Chinatown and Little Tokyo and Koreatown, and those really visible of Asian area. In Miami, we just don't have that. So when you look at the Florida, and then a lot of people didn't realize how many Asians really living in Florida. And then when it comes to the 2012 election, and how many of already registered to vote, and comparing look at like 2000, the elections only have a difference of about 507 votes for really make a difference from one president selection to the other one. And then so right now as of July 2012, we have about over 180,000 registered Asian voters in Florida.
Oh, that's tremendous. You have done an awful lot of good helping to organize people, helping them to realize how large the Asian community is here. During that initial period right after the Patriot Act was passed, was there an increase in harassment issues? I know you were working to help make sure that was not a problem, that people understood the issues. Has that kind of thing begun to ebb? Are you seeing less racial harassment in that arena?
Right, in the Asian in the Florida state, it's really like we've been in some area we've been okay. We don't really receiving so much harassment, except like the Islamic community and also like the some other like Middle Eastern. They may see a lot more this kind of hatred to them. And in general, the other like the Asian community, we are not really impacting so much in Florida. And however, I know in New York and other area, they do really have a lot more impact comparing to other area.
Okay, well that's good. Tell me, Winnie, one of the questions that I always ask my guests is, so difficult to make a living, to raise one's family, to help one's community. It always takes a special person to go beyond and above and to work and try to build relations with the community to do work to make this a better world. What was it in your life that brought you out, that made you commit to working to make this a better world?
Well, what I is really thinking about is the changing of my life is really like used to be just how you say as a very close individual working, go to work and spend time with family and friends and kind of really regular life. But I had one time there with the OCA, which is attending a leadership program, and go to Washington, D.C., and see how hard the Asian community leader in Washington, D.C., working to really fighting for the welfare and the right for the Asian community in the Washington, D.C. So for that, I'm kind of really saying that, wait a minute, I don't really see that much thing going on in Florida, in Miami. So when I came back and I started really like getting to know the community better and getting to know what's going on, so then I was spending a lot more time to really working whatever that I find is very interest and also really good to helping people. And so from there on, it just every single one that I doing is really not only by helping people, but also for the personal, I gain a lot of, how you say, friends and knowledge and everything to really make me as a better person comparing to the one that's like taking care of my, spending time to develop my own professional interest and everything. So I feel that by doing the community work, it certainly is really helping me grow as a better individual.
Well, thank you so much, Winnie. I sure appreciate your time. I hope you can come back sometime, okay?
Definitely. And also one thing, I want to really say one more thing is really want to make sure the listener, they will hear that also a lot of Asian, they may have a lot of Asian friends, then they may also to really talk to the Asian friend to really to go out to vote, because this is really to representing our, also that a lot of people didn't know that we have the power to really influence the policy making, to really make that to be a better place for everybody to live. So just want to have all the people, and if they have friends in the Asian community, also have them to connect them so we can work a lot more together.
Well, Winnie, thanks again. Thanks so much for all the good work that you do. You take care.
Thank you so much, Rick. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Jose Suarez. Jose, welcome.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
Very good, sir, very good. So, Jose, tell us, what's new at SEIU?
Well, we're working hard, Rick. As you know, this weekend was the first weekend of the early voting period, and we've been working all summer preparing for this moment. And I think that if you look at the initial reports from yesterday, we're getting record numbers in the state of people getting out to vote. We were out in Miami, Florida yesterday. We were in Delray Beach. We were in Orlando. We were in Tampa. We were in Jacksonville, where we even had some voters out there who wanted to kind of camp out and what they called occupy the vote to make sure that they would be one of the first ones in there. We had pastors come out from all over in these areas. We had Reverend Al Sharpton down in Miami, and we had a huge kickoff. Some people were in line 7 hours at some of the polling locations. There was one in North Miami that stayed open till midnight, just to get the people that were already in line by the time they closed.
No kidding.
Yeah, so we're really seeing people motivated. You know, it was kickoff to Operation Lemonade, as we've been calling it. One of the pastors here, Bishop Victor T. Curry, out of New Birth, he coined it Operation Lemonade, because we know our great governor, took a day of early voting away from us to try to stop some of us and discourage some of us because he knows how important Sundays are to us. So Bishop Curry said Governor Scott gave us some lemons, and we were going to make some lemonade out of it, and we were going to get out and get everybody voting. So we had officially the kickoff to Operation Lemonade statewide.
Well, you know, again, in that same vein, making lemonade out of lemons, I'll tell you what, those Republicans are so scared of organized labor, they have good reason. They have damn good reason, because united we are strong. Solidarność, brother. It's exactly. So good to hear the news.
You know, over the summer, just to give you a clue, we've been working closely with an organization, Florida New Majority. We actually were out in the streets. We've knocked on over 200,000 doors to get people to vote and vote early and vote for the right people, for candidates that are going to stand up to support the middle class. They're going to fight for good jobs, for access to quality health care and education, and to also level the playing field a little bit when it comes to taxes. Because we, you know, the community out there is definitely fired up. They're tired of what, you know, kind of going on with the same agenda that's gotten us into this mess in the first place.
I'll tell you, you know, when you see how the unions have pulled together in the face of this just across the board attack, it reminds you how far we've come and how far we still have to go. You know, I can't see a union rally today without seeing union men being shot and beaten in the streets. What was it, just 100 years ago? And, you know, we have to hang together now, and you guys are doing the work. That's great. What's ahead?
Well, I mean, we're going to continue pushing people to vote and getting people out because we need to bring this home. We need to bring this home, and we need to bring it home for President Obama, for candidates like President Obama. And I'm just going to tell you a story. You know, Governor Scott tried a little ploy a few months ago, if you remember, in the spring, where he tried to purge some voters from the rolls.
Yep.
And when you look at that list, that initial list of the people that got a very intimidating letter that threatened them even with prosecution if they tried to get out and vote without having to prove their citizenship a second time, okay? A class of people that were targeted because of their last names and where they came from. And yesterday we had Melinda Antoine, who was a nurse, who is a Haitian-American, who came from Haiti to seek a better life, like, you know, like countless stories through history here in this country.
Right.
Was a citizen, has been a citizen for many, many years, has voted in past elections. She received one of those letters along with her husband. And, you know, she decided to know that she was going to stand up to it. She was one of two citizens who entered into a lawsuit against the state of Florida for them trying to purge the list, using a bad list. At the end of the day, more than 90% of the people on that list were citizens that had the right to vote. And I got to see her vote yesterday, and it's a very inspirational moment. Took me back to the days when I remember my own parents that came here as political refugees from Cuba.
Sure.
You know, became citizens, and I remember being a kid and watching them vote for the first time and how happy they were. So it was a big day. No matter what they try to do, they can take our money, they can take our jobs, but they can't take our vote away, and that's what we're letting them know right now.
My grandmother, who came from the old country over in Europe, from Slovakia, she was so intimidated by the pressure that was put upon them that she never voted. She lived to 96 years old. She was always afraid to vote. So when I hear a story like that, that makes me feel that we've made some progress.
We have made a lot of progress, Rick, and we'll continue to fight. We'll continue to do what we have to do, you know, because Florida is important. A lot of our residents here, you know, that live in this state are still suffering, you know, from decisions that were made a very, very, very long time ago. And, you know, labor's committed to the community because we know we need the community. And, you know, we're working closely with a lot of community partners, not just in Florida, but around the country. You know, Florida, I tell you, I mean, I've sat there. I've been to several polling locations throughout the state, and I see a lot of people energized, Rick. Like, I've never seen them energized before. People were talking about, you know, that this wasn't going to be like 2008, and I think they coined it, but for all the wrong reasons, because I think it's going to be better than 2008 at the end of the day.
That's good to hear, buddy. That's good to hear. I assume that there's some more rallies coming up.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure we're pushing all throughout the early voting period, and there'll be different activities. I mean, you know, the Souls to the Poll, kind of the churches had the Souls to the Poll weekend. I was at the Caleb Center today in Miami, and, you know, just an incredible turnout of pastors and their congregations and citizens at large in there that, you know, are really talking about the need to vote, not just as a right that's been given to us by the Constitution, but because we live in this great country and because, in a sense, it is under attack and we do have to support the candidates that are going to fight for us, you know, making it it's part of our moral duty to get out there and vote. I mean, we've got candidates out there that, you know, want to talk about freedom, yet they want to tell us what to do on everything. They want to keep people from the polls. I mean, it's just, that kind of stuff is just un-American.
So let me ask you this, Jose. Do you think that many people, should the worst happen and the Romney Gasp Ryan team get in the White House, do you think there'll be a lot of voluntary deportations?
I have no, you know, I don't even want to think about what happens if that were to take place, Rick. But you know what? I have faith in the American people. I have faith in the fact that people are getting out there to vote. And I have faith that people are going to do the right thing when they step in that booth.
I hope you're right, my friend. I absolutely hope you're right. And I hope that all those forces that want to remove the franchise from so many and adjust the votes according to their favorite selection. I hope all that is defeated by a good solid win. Let me ask you this. With that incredibly complex set of amendment votes people have to make, they've outdone themselves, these Republicans, in making the most convoluted language I've ever seen, and I've been voting in this benighted state my entire political life. Do you think part of it is just they want to get people, you know, to slow them down, to keep people from voting fast enough and getting them through there? I mean, I almost think that part of this is they want to just slow the process down so that enough people won't get a chance to vote. I heard people saying that there was an hour wait with a really short line simply because of all those things. Is there a voting guide up on the SEIU website?
No, there's not, but, you know, we do have a voting guide on the 1199 site. I'm sorry about that. We do a list of candidates that we have endorsed. There's also, you know, I would suggest that people also go to websites like the advancementproject.org and that they get the information. There's a lot of information there about voting. You know, go to the polls knowing what to expect. You can find sample ballots all over the place. You can call the supervisor of elections. You can swing by the office. I've seen them being handed out in many polling locations. But the key is this, and you're absolutely right. We've got politicians that have put amendments on that ballot that's costing people, in some cases, as much as 35, 40 minutes just to cast their vote. I think that's ridiculous when, you know, for something like that to happen during an election that's as big as it is. So I'll tell you what, if you have any question about those ballots on there in your county, because there are a lot of them, and some of them are just going to take more power away from the people, are going to give more money back to big corporations and the super rich, okay, vote no, because this is the country of the majority, and our government needs to start working for the majority, because it isn't right now. And
yeah,
it'd
be a real change.
It's because of the decisions that have been made, you know, way before Barack Obama got in office.
That's for sure. Jose, let me ask you that question I always ask. You know, I think it's so admirable that progressives can come on here and talk about the good work that you're doing, and I salute the work that you're doing, brother. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you motivated. What took you from being just another consumer out there to a person who really had to put their life energy into making this a better world? What was it that turned you on to that, brother?
Well, actually, it's I was on the other side, Rick. I'm just going to be honest about it up front. I worked for big corporate America. I heard about how bad labor was. I heard about how bad community organizing was, and that it was evil and all this kind of stuff. And you know what? I sat there and I worked for a large corporation, and I saw it go from a really great company to a company where employees were no longer satisfied. And when the economy tanks, before those executives stop getting their bonuses, and, you know, they start cutting jobs. And so I lost my job for one of these big corporations here in the state of Florida. And I actually even painted houses with a buddy of mine. I worked in there for almost 10 years in communications. And, you know, one day my fiance actually told me to look on Craigslist, because I was on Monster and I was on all these places. And I figured Craigslist was the last place I'd look for, because I wasn't looking for a sofa or a bed. I was looking for a job. And, you know, and at the end of the day, I was on there, and I answered. I applied for a job with One Miami, and I thought that it was a great concept. And it was about bringing the community together to fight for our rights, to get us, you know, motivated. I worked with people, and I met people every day whose stories were way worse than mine and lived much worse conditions that were completely out of their control, that they had never done anything to cause, people that had lived their life the right way their entire life, and now they were seeing themselves hurting because of the decision of others and the fact, and it just comes down to greed at the end of the day. And I got to work when I was at One Miami. I got to work a lot with SCIU, and I saw what a great organization SCIU was and how hard SCIU fights for its members, and how it fights for the community, and how it stands behind people that are, you know, naturalized citizens or citizens that may have even been born here, but because of their last name or where they or their parents may have come from, that there's actually elected officials that are trying to take them off the list, and SCIU is right there as a bastion for those people to help them stand up and make their voices heard. And I just could never imagine having the opportunity to work for a better place. I told you, to just be able to experience and watch how proud Melandi Antoine was yesterday as she cast her ballot, and being able to help raise her voice in the media. You know, I mean, what more satisfaction can you get than that out of your job? And it's working for people that have the best interest of the majority in mind. And sometimes it's the majority that's forgotten about.
Well, you know, I think that's wonderful, buddy. You've seen the dark side, and you came to work with the people, and I think that's awesome. Thank you so much, brother, for all the work that you do, and keep up the good work. We want to hear from you again, okay?
Rick, it's always great talking to you, buddy. Thanks for all the good work you do.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Jose Suarez, Communications Director with SEIU. A wonderful man, a guy working every day to make sure that this is a better world. And next up, we've got an interview with Stratton Pulitzer, Deputy Director of Equality of Florida. Just one second, and we'll get that played for you. Don't forget, if you've got an announcement you'd like us to make, send your email to news@averyvoice.com, and we'll get your announcement on the air. Here we go, the interview with Stratton Pulitzer. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, and today I've got Stratton Pulitzer, Deputy Director of Equality of Florida. Did I get that correct, Stratton?
You sure did, Rick. Good to be here.
Well, sir, I want to welcome you, and, you know, we're in the heat of electoral season. We've got the suddenly moderate Republicans running for president. who are saying, it seems, anything they want, whatever they think the people need to hear right now to get elected. But I was curious, sir, what is it that you're working on right now?
Well, you know, Equality Florida is the statewide lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights organization. So, you know, our mission is to change Florida law to protect LGBT people from discrimination. We live in a state where, under state law, it's still legal to fire people for being gay, and our relationships have virtually no recognition whatsoever under state law. Couples who have been together for decades are treated as strangers. But the good news is that we are making dramatic progress in the state of Florida at the local level, that we have passed anti-bullying protections for 60% of Florida's LGBT students, that one in three Floridians has access to a domestic partner registry where they live or work, and that more than half of the state is protected from workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity through a local ordinance, a county or a city ordinance. So we are making very strong progress at the local level. We're working actually on over 20 local campaigns right now, and all of it hopefully is adding up to the day when we have statewide victories. So that's one of the major projects that we're engaged in right now. But then, of course, the other, as you alluded to, is the elections. This is a pivotal election year in terms of gay rights. Florida, of course, is one of the states that all eyes turn to across the nation in terms of the presidential elections. But up and down the ballot, we see tremendous opportunities this year in Florida, largely because of the fact that for the first time in 10 years, Florida has gone through redistricting, and the state legislative districts have been drawn not perfectly, but certainly more fairly than we have seen in the past. And it means there are some fantastic chances this year. We have already in 2012 in the primary elected Florida's first gay state representative. It's so important to have a member of our community actually at the table in Tallahassee for the first time. And there are two more very strong gay candidates running who will be on the ballot in November, who we think have an excellent chance of winning, and that would really have a dramatic impact on the things we fight for in our state capital to have three members of our community there for the first time.
Absolutely. It seems to me that I have seen, at least among the activists that I know, a far more emphasis, a far greater emphasis on that down-ticket side of things. Because without the legislators, without the county people who understand and respect human rights, we can't expect much from the top of the ticket. And are you seeing the same thing? Are you seeing a lot more people working on these down-ticket races just to make sure that we have some people who have some kind of progressive thinking in there in some of these local and state offices?
No, we really are. I mean, it all starts locally. And if you don't do the hard work of electing folks to your city and county commissions who support and share your values, then you'll never make it to your state government or to Congress with folks who really stand with your community. So what we see in Florida right now is that increasingly there are folks on both sides of the aisle who support LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender equality. And for example, in Orange County, just in the last year, a county that has only one Democrat on the commission and has a Republican mayor and a almost entirely Republican county commission, they have unanimously passed domestic partner benefits, a domestic partner registry, and a non-discrimination policy for Orange County, home to Orlando. And what we know is because increasingly our state leaders, our state senators and representatives come from a community where they have already wrestled with one of these issues, where they already have these protections in place, it greatly increases the chances that they'll stand with us in Tallahassee. But if they get to Tallahassee, having never talked about gay rights, having never taken a stand or been asked to take a stand, then we face a much more difficult conversation, particularly with folks who come from more conservative communities.
You're absolutely right there, that's for sure. And it's really refreshing to see more and more of our progressive Democrats standing, supporting human rights. It's just an absolute necessity. Let me ask you this. The national debates that we've heard on the contemporary issues of jobs, of foreign relations, they seem to have had almost nothing to say about, the, you know, beyond jobs and beyond Middle Eastern policy. Have you heard that same thing? Do you see, sense that same lack?
Well, I think what we have seen that's been in some ways a positive sign is that our community, the gay community, has not been treated in this national election cycle as a political punching bag. That in the past, what we've experienced is an attempt by the right wing to raise gay rights issues as a way of trying to score points with their base.
Sure.
And while there's been some of that this year, I think what one of the things that the 2012 election cycle has shown is that that's a dangerous recipe today, that a clear majority of voters all across the country, including now in Florida, stand in support of marriage equality, and overwhelming majorities support non-discrimination laws that include the gay community. So it's been a positive sign that we don't see this issue brought up in a negative way. We are also beginning to see more niche marketing. You may have heard the Obama campaign's commercials that are targeting young voters that absolutely talk about gay rights, that young people really see this as the civil rights movement of their generation, and wide majorities of people under 30 support everything we're fighting for. So it has been good to see the Obama campaign recognize that and use it as a plus in their messaging, at least in terms of that demographic.
Absolutely. Also, those court wins just recently on DOMA.
Sure. No, I mean, that's particularly important for folks who live in what we think of as the other 30 states. When you look at the gay rights movement across the country, a great deal has been achieved in 20 blue states in terms of state policy. A great deal has been achieved locally in the other red states, but state governments in red states have not passed much in support of LGBT equality. These court challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act have the potential to begin giving real benefits to people no matter where you live. Because just to break that down for folks, right now, a gay couple who gets married in Massachusetts or New York or Connecticut or Iowa, the federal government doesn't recognize that marriage. So they don't get any of the Social Security benefits. They don't get any of the tax benefits. There are a huge number of benefits that flow from the federal government. If this lawsuit, one of these lawsuits, goes to the Supreme Court and is successful, then immediately any gay or lesbian couple who gets married in the United States, in one of the states that currently recognizes marriage, would receive all of those federal benefits, no matter what your home state was. So I could, for instance, go with my husband to New York and get married and come back to Florida and have all of those federal benefits immediately. So this has a huge impact in particular for those of us in the red states.
Well, that's great. Stratton, I would like to ask you one more thing, sir. Those of us who try to do something to help out, it to me is a very special thing. You know, it's hard enough to make a living, to have your relationships, to help with your family, but it takes something special. It takes some special moment in most people's lives to take them beyond themselves and to try to bring them to a place where they want to contribute to the community. What was it in your life, sir, that took you from being just another consumer, another citizen, to someone who really wanted to try to make a better world?
Well, I grew up in the Deep South, in a little town in South Carolina. My family's been there for 150 years, and for all of that time, they've been sort of crazy, crazy, crazy liberals. Back
wow.
in the day, they were abolitionists, then they were suffragettes, then they were desegregationists.
Wow.
So I think in part it was just my legacy, but also, you know, as a white man growing up in the South in the 70s, you saw the terrible cost of prejudice every day. I grew up in a historic black community, and you saw the crushing institutionalized poverty, the failure to provide adequate education, public education in our community, and you just grew up with a burning sense that you wanted to be a part of the solution. That probably was what put me on this path, but I can tell you that the reason that it has become my career, and I've been at Equality Florida for 15 years, is that this work is joyful. It's a tremendous privilege to be able to participate in it. One of my favorite quotes that I've heard as an activist is from a Massachusetts legislator named Bayard Rushing, who's a longtime civil rights activist. And about 15 years ago, he was addressing a national gay gathering that I was a part of, a huge audience. And he told us, he said, "You will not see the end of this civil rights movement in your lifetime. If that's why you're here, because you want to reach that destination, I'm here to tell you, you're not going to see it completed in your lifetime. It will go on and on and on. But you have the marvelous privilege of living while it's happening and being able to participate in it." And that's really how I feel every day when I get to do this work.
Oh, that's beautifully put, sir. Beautifully put. I want to thank you for the tremendous comments you've made today. They're an important part of PNN and what we're about. Human rights is almost the beginning and the end of a true civilization. And I think the work that you're doing is helping to make this a better world. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay. Have a good day, sir. Hope to have you back again. Bye-bye. That was Stratton Pulitzer, Deputy Director of Equality of Florida. And we've got a couple more interviews to play. I want to play a segment of something that I'm kind of going to tease you with, because we're going to have the author on next week. But this is a little piece. It's a bit of an interview of Dennis Campbell, the publisher of UK Progressive. He's breaking a story on the David Pakman show. This is just a couple minutes of it. I think you want to hear this. It seems that he's got a contact in the NSA, National Security Administration, who's leaking information about GOP election tampering. This is Dennis Campbell, an excerpt of David Pakman show.
It's Thursday and time for Worldview with Dennis Campbell. Dennis is editor-in-chief of UK Progressive Magazine, also author of the book Billionaire Boys Election Freak Show. Dennis, you're coming to us today with what could be a huge, huge story. We've been covering potential election fraud and irregularities for quite some time now. We recently had the story linking Tag Romney to some of the voting machines in Ohio. But now you're in touch with a former NSA agent who believes he has uncovered actual election fraud on behalf of the Romney campaign. Tell us about it.
Well, it's not just the Romney campaign. It's the GOP in general. Now, a little bit of background in history. I have been writing stories about election fraud in Arizona since 2006. There was a bond issue election there that had some very funny numbers, and I got in touch with a group of people down there who have been trying now for the better part of 6 years to construct an actual paper trail so they can see what happened in this particular election. Their work in this regard has been going on for 6 years just in that. The gentleman who I am associated with is the former NSA analyst. His name is Michael Donahoe. Now, Michael and I have had a relationship, a friendship, for almost 17 years. We were neighbors when we lived back in Maryland in the United States many years ago. So I've known him for quite some time. He's a very soft-spoken, understated sort of gentleman, a true analyst in every sense of the word. He was sent a link by somebody to a report. This report is by a gentleman by the name of Chiquet. Let me just get his first name, Francois Chiquet and James Johnson. Now, what happened is that Francois was looking at election results, and an election observer during the South Carolina primary made an observation. It said, gee, the number of voters for Romney is showing an uncharacteristically high rate of return. And that was questioning and questionable. So Chiquet and Johnson are a couple of analysts. They went back and they looked at all of the votes that have been tabulated in that particular state. And they saw a shocking sort of correlation between the size of the precinct. So the larger the precinct, the more votes tended to go up for Romney and down for everybody else.
So let's stop right there for a second.
Yep.
Okay, that's the excerpt we have of Dennis Campbell talking on the Pakman Show. We're going to be talking to Dennis next week, but I wanted to show that to you before we get on to our next interview of the show. I do want to mention that in addition to this show, there are some other good progressive shows you should be paying attention to. One of them is Gwen Holden Berry's Here Be Monsters, an important progressive show. Another one is Brian Stetton's Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon's Nylon Report, Robert Abstin's new show called Smile, political progressive politics with a little humorous spin on it, and Anita Stewart's Wise Women Media. These are all good, solid progressive shows you should be paying attention to. And now, without any further ado, we're going to bring on the author of The Wonderful Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, Greg Palast, who we had a chance to interview, and he has got a tremendous book out there. You definitely have to read this. It's a must for anybody who's concerned about American politics. And especially pay attention to the end. He's got an appendix, Ways You Can Protect Your Votes. He's also got a listing of important organizations and, of course, also news organizations you should be paying attention to. So Greg Palast's book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, you should be paying attention to. Tremendous book. I urge you to read it. And then now here is Greg Palast. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Greg Palast, incredible economic reporter, political reporter, a writer beyond par who can help us understand what's really going on in America's electoral system. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Palast.
Well, glad to be with you.
It's our pleasure to have you, sir. Listen, you've got an incredible book out there, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, which really totally takes apart the electoral system. Greg, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, Obama doesn't come out smelling too well on this either. Billionaires and Ballot Bandits includes his billionaires and ballot bandits, but he has fewer billionaires, and they don't know how to burgle as many ballots as the GOP this year, because the GOP, as the Republicans have, they've got these massive data mining systems, as I describe in the book, and they're really good at it. So the Republicans have really moved. They're at the edge of cyberspace with vote rustling, while the Democrats are still playing with their floppy disks. So that's crucial. So the subtitle is really two subtitles on this book, because it's kind of two books or three books slapped together. Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. First, How to Steal an Election, 9 Easy Steps. And second subtitle is Greg Palast Investigates the Koch Gang, Karl Rove, and Their Butt Buddies. So I wanted to describe how the election is being stolen, and it is, and how the billionaires, and who these billionaires are that are stealing it. And I say a third book because in the middle, of course, there's a 50-page comic book by Ted Rall, which I think is worth the price.
Excellent. It is. It's excellent. Well, you show how the underlying money behind both parties is, in fact, absolutely corruptive. And then we also see, and you detail it perfectly, how not only does the money corrupt, but the money corrupts the entire system, from the judiciary to Congress, as well as the leadership at the top.
Yeah, well, it's old-fashioned gumshoe reporting. I'm not just, blathering on about, the 1% and the rich or whatever. I actually know these guys. I went to the University of Chicago, studied under Milton Friedman, so I know a lot of these billionaire freaks, why they're strange and dangerous. They never got any action in college. That was one of the reasons, and the people I know that closed their legs or kept their pants zipped now are all paying because he wouldn't take care of these guys. They are little sick guys, okay? They're sicksters. For example, we have a story, several chapters, about the Koch brothers in there. I say we, because Bobby Kennedy wrote a couple chapters of the book. I have these chapters on the Koch brothers, one where Charles Koch is siphoning oil off the Osage Indian Reservation. He's ordering the siphoning of oil personally. Now, that's getting him a few hundred bucks a week. The guy is a billionaire. The guy was a billionaire, and he's ordering the theft of oil from some poor Indians. And one of his minions says to him, why? You're a billionaire. Why are you taking a few hundred bucks from some poor Indian? And I know his answer because his vice president was with him. Was wired. I was working with the FBI at the time. So we had him wired. And the guy, and Charles Koch said, and this is a direct quote, Koch said, I want my fair share, and that's all of it. And that's, they want all of it. And so the only way to get all of it
is by, you have to, that has to include Capitol Hill and the White House. They need that real estate because you can't get all of it. You can't steal all of it unless you get immunity from the crime and protection, and then, of course, make sure you're never taxed on the skim. That's how it works. And now today, so Koch is getting close. He's got, he and his brother each have $22 billion in assets, each. $22 billion, that's 44. But if you throw in their other two dissolute brothers, that puts them over $50 billion for the four Koch brothers. And you know what? As Mitt Romney says, well, Republican Party, we celebrate success. What he means is we celebrate dressage horses. We celebrate money. I always thought, you know, my mother was a school teacher, worked in the school cafeteria. I thought she was a success. But, you know, and she didn't take any money from Indian tribes. But they celebrate success. The question is, success at what? And I guess we have to celebrate along with them. And that's, you know, so that's the point of the book is, and how they, and then once they got that money, how they systematically have been deep sixing 5.9 million, in the last election, 5.9 million votes just went poof.
There's so many issues that are raised. For one, have to wonder, why, if we have this on the record, has there been no prosecution of these guys? Of course, which leads back to the fact that the judicial system doesn't prosecute rich people. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Here, these guys are on the record stealing from the Native Americans. And have you heard of any prosecutions? I certainly haven't.
Well, in fact, it's interesting because, see, while we talk about the influence of the rich and how they steal with impunity, I wanted to show you exactly how. I'm an investigative reporter, and to the point, like you said to me before, you know, got on the air, that you know you gulped down the book in a sitting, and that the reason is that I'm telling stories, not just gassing. I say, oh, the rich have it all locked up. Well, that's not news to anyone. What makes the book fun and interesting is I tell you how. So, for example, on page 72, I have the pre-indictment write-up of Charles Koch. He's called Target 67C. And I'm reading it right now, page 60. In fact, you got all these cool, besides the comic book, you have a lot of cool illustrations. This one is from the U.S. Department of Justice. It says, Koch Industries, crime on an Indian reservation, theft, racketeering, influenced, and corrupt organization. That's the RICO law. So they're going to charge Koch Industries and Charles Koch with racketeering, a big federal crime, believe me, felony crime. And so why wasn't Koch indicted? If we had the videotape of the theft, we have his confessions on audio tape, we have the whole thing. So how come Koch is picking our next president as opposed to, you know, picking cotton on some state prison farm? And the answer is that the indictment was written up, but the prosecutor in any state, federal prosecutor, serves at the pleasure of the state's U.S. senator. And Senator Don Nichols was not pleasured by the impending indictment of his biggest donor and sugar daddy, Mr. Koch. So he had the prosecutor removed, replaced with a Koch stooge. The grand jury was disbanded without being allowed to look at any evidence. They didn't see this indictment write-up. And Koch even got a letter from the new puppet prosecutor saying, you're off the hook, you won't be indicted, which is quite unusual. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card, do whatever you want. That's just an example from that one crime. There were several other crimes, including, for example, Koch Industries then went out and bought up the U.S. Congress through illegal campaign contributions, $25 billion, from Koch Industries. Now, remember, it was illegal for corporations to give money to campaigns. People can, but corporations can't. So then we ended up with Citizens United. There were no citizens in there. Who were these citizens who were uniting? Well, that case was argued at the Supreme Court by this little group. They used the most expensive attorney in America, Ted Olson. How did they pay for him? The answer was, he's on the payroll of Koch Industries. So when Citizens United came down, it wasn't as simple matter as allowing corporations to donate to political campaigns by the millions and billions. It decriminalized what the Kochs had done. Basically, they committed the crime already, and now they say, well, it's not a crime. So So you have to understand that's the game. It's not just what a billionaire does. Yes, the way that they stop breaking the law is by changing the law. So Citizens United was decriminalizing actions of the Koch brothers. And that's the game. So this is how it is. But you get the full stories in here. You know, you get the details, which are what's fun, you know, like how this stuff happens and how, of course, I go about getting this info.
This is a story that every American should read. It should be part of the history process. It should be part of the civics process. Because essentially, if we allow these supra-citizens, as defined by the Supreme Court, control the money that undergirds our election system, there is no more even illusion of democracy. And that's a terrible thing. The other component of this that you reveal is essentially, since they can't run a candidate that anyone who thinks would ever support, they have to turn to voter suppression, voter intimidation, to get their election results that they want.
Yeah, it's called stealing. We use the term suppression, disenfranchisement, which are very academic terms for burgling your vote, your ballot. And at the first chapter of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, we have, I just have a listing from, based on the figures from the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission, in which, for example, you have 1,451,116 ballots spoiled. That means that they're cast and they're not counted. 1.4 million votes cast and not counted in the last election. That's the official number. Now, how do votes spoil? Well, you don't leave them out of the refrigerator. Don't leave them out of the refrigerator. That's not what happens. That means that you had a stray mark on a ballot. Your CHAD was hung. You put an X instead of a check, or didn't fill in a bubble, or you forgot to fill in a bubble, or something like that, or you didn't add your middle initial to your signature as you registered. All kinds of games, if you mailed in your ballot, all kinds of games are played. And if it were random, if it were both sides doing it equally, and if it were random, it wouldn't change elections. But it's not random. And here's the statistics you have to look at in the chapter Lynching by Laptop. The chance your vote will spoil, that is, you cast it and it's not counted, is 900% higher if you're African American than if you're white. 500% higher if you're Hispanic than if you're white. By the way, if you're Native American, forget it. The number is through the roof. You have a tough time getting your vote counted at all. And that's not minor, because the swing states, for example, in this election, Missouri, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, you have this massive concentration of Native American voters who are, by the way, like 7-1 Democrats. There is 7 or 8-1. They are as Democratic as African Americans. People don't realize that. And their vote is under threat. And how do they do this? They give, just like they give black and Hispanic neighborhoods and Indian pueblos the worst schools and the worst hospitals, they also give them the worst voting machines, which don't record the vote or screw up. And they know it. They like it. It's deliberate. That's the game.
I volunteered in the 2000 election in a city that was largely agricultural, largely lower middle class. And I was talking to the mayor afterwards, and I said, you know, the machines were turned on late. How were our results tallied? He said, well, you know, it's funny you should ask. He said, because, you know what, they never even picked up our voting results. He said, I had to call them at 1 o'clock in the morning because they never came and collected our voting results. So all those people who voted in Florida City were not counted. So when they finally begrudgingly came down to pick them up, he said, I wanted a letter from the election department saying that these votes will in fact be counted. He never heard back. And Florida is notorious, as you well know, for all kinds of shenanigans.
So notorious that without any question in my mind, Florida's already stolen. I don't think Obama could win, even though the demographics of Florida over the last 4 years have changed. He won by a third of a percentage point last time in Florida. Now, I'm not for Obama or against Obama. I'm for the votes getting counted. I don't care if Obama flies or explodes. That's not the point. The point is, do we have something that we used to call democracy? And it's not in Florida. For example, you have in Florida a governor who said that there are 182,000 illegal aliens registered on the voter rolls. Now, this means that you have a massive, massive crime wave in Florida that no one, that the Republicans are doing nothing about. Because if you're an illegal alien and you register to vote, you've committed a felony crime for which you first go to jail and then you get deported. Now, how come the Republicans, who are so much against voter fraud, aren't arresting these people? Jesus, it's not like it's difficult. They give you their name and address, right? Yeah. They say they're going to show up to vote on this on November 6th. It's pretty easy to put handcuffs on them, but they don't, because the lie, the phony, it's a con. We don't have illegal aliens in Florida on the voter rolls. When I say we don't have any, pretty much any. In fact, I told the governor, Mr. Scott of Florida, if you can find not 182,000 illegal aliens on the voter rolls, but 182, one in a thousand, and arrest them. No, you can't say, oh, Jose Hernandez, oh, we have a Jose Hernandez on the voter rolls, and we want to deport a guy named Jose Hernandez. Well, no kidding. That's not evidence of voter fraud. Evidence of voter fraud is you go and arrest this supposed felon, Jose Hernandez, who was deported, swam the Gulf of Mexico, came out of the water and registered to vote so he could, you know, so he could vote for Barack Obama. You arrest that guy. They've arrested one person, a Canadian registered as a Republican. Out of 182,000 people, one arrest. One. A Canadian Republican. And that's it, out of 182,000. So I told him if he found just 182, I would, so he has 181 to go. If he can find them, fine. In fact, I said, I will eat Governor Scott's underpants in the Capitol Rotunda. And I am still hungry. It hasn't happened because it's a lie. And you know why the lie continues? Because the lie is echoed in the lie chamber. National Petroleum Radio, NPR, in Billionaires and Ballot Bans, there's a chapter called I'm Depressed. I'm an investigative reporter. For those who know Greg Palast, I'm an investigative reporter for BBC TV, Democracy Now!, and other programs. And so the NPR's idea of a report is that they say, on one hand this and on the other hand that. I call it phony balancism, okay? They say experts are saying that there are no illegal aliens on the voter rolls, that the Republicans have 182,000 common Hispanic names. There's not that many. That's what they have. So someone's been deported and they have the same name as someone in Florida. So what? Okay. But NPR said, on the other hand, Republican state officials do have evidence, strong evidence, that there are many illegal aliens on the voter rolls. Now, wait a minute, NPR. If there's strong evidence, what are their names? Have they been arrested? Where are they? Is anyone trying to get these illegal voters? No. But NPR repeats it as gospel truth. In other words, because it's important for them to run a report that says, when I work for BBC, we have to get an answer. If the Democrats say these are real legal citizens, the Republicans say they aren't, it is not my job as a reporter to say, the Democrats say this and the Republicans say that. That's not reporting. That's repeating. Reporting means that you take all the evidence and you investigate yourself and you find the answer. Either the Democrats are lying and they're running a campaign to get all these people to swim across the Rio Grande and steal the election, or the Republicans are running a Jose Crow operation to steal this election for the rich using racist apartheid tactics. And by the way, the answer is B, racism. It's lynching by laptop, as I call it in the book. Boy, I'm getting all excited! The book is pretty funny, actually. It's not all that. No one's screaming at you from the covers. It's usually more humor than... It's sick humor. It's sad humor. But that's how it is.
Well, Greg, your book is tremendous. I urge everyone who has any interest at all in politics, in election, to get out there and get that book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And it's not only is it a book about the damage being done, but it's also got how-to in there, how we can improve it, how we can take a stand, how we can contribute to remaking our democracy.
Well, that's right. At the back of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, I have what we call the ballot condom for safe voting, 7 ways to beat the ballot bandits. And it's 7 things you could do to protect your vote, especially in your Florida. One is don't mail in your ballot. Don't go postal, for God's sake. These are vote thieves, and you mail them yourself. It's like mailing bank robbers your check deposit. Don't forget to deposit this check, please. Florida is famous for getting absentee mail-in ballots. mail-in ballots, and then just not opening them until the day after the election day or the day before the election day. Oh, oops, it's past the deadline. Now, they've been holding these ballots. Or even better, one of the favorites in Florida is they don't send back your ballot in time. You make a ballot request, and they send it back to you too late. They know who you are. They know how you're voting. How do they know this? Well, one, even the dumbest politician knows from zip code your likely vote. Second, in Florida, in places like that, it says, if you're African American, it says BLA next to your name in the voter registries. They know how you're voting there. But even more sophisticated is that, as you read in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, is that Karl Rove has a massive data mining system called Data Trust. And the Koch brothers have funded a massive data mining system called Themis. Themis and Data Trust, you put those together, and these guys, they literally have said, we know if you've bought pornography in the week before the election. They have your credit card records, okay? They can buy all this stuff, all right? Understand. They have your records. They know you inside and out. They know you're going to vote before you know how you're going to vote. They've got you totally profiled. You mail in your ballot, and then they come up with ways to knock you out. Say, oh, fraudulent address. This is a felon voter. That's one of my favorites, by the way, especially in Florida. Most people know Greg Palast, know me, as the guy that uncovered how Catherine Harris back in 2000 fixed the election for George Bush by removing tens of thousands of black people from the voter rolls, saying that they were felons, ex-cons, that these ex-cons are not permitted to vote. Okay, if there's ex-cons on the, like I say, first of all, if there's an ex-con that's registered to vote, that tries to vote, arrest them. That's another crime. Send them back to jail. Now, so how many ex-cons in Florida are going to take the chance of going back to the Hooskow so they can vote for a school bond or even Barack Obama? Come on. No one's going to do that. And the answer is no one does that. No one does that. You know how many? I went to the attorney general. I said, would you arrest a felon voter, an illegal voter who has a felony conviction? Absolutely. I said, how many have you arrested? I said, well, we have six open cases, no conviction. Six? I said, the list is 93,000 names. 93,000 people were losing their vote.
Well, the thing that I find amazing is that even given the bought-off mouthpiece that the press has become, even there, some of these cases are leaking out. We've got the guy who's been throwing out Democratic ballots. We've got the guy in Pennsylvania who said, oh, listen, we've secured the state for Romney months ago.
By using ID laws. And see, the thing about the guy with the dumpster, the ballots in the dumpster, that's not voter fraud. People say, oh, and see, that actually plays to the Republican idea that they're voters who are committing, no, it's officials who are committing fraud against voters. That was voter victimization. Those are people who would fill out ballot registration forms, and they are thrown in the dumpster. But you know what? The guy who threw the stuff in the dumpster is nothing compared to the Secretary of State of Florida, who's been throwing tens of thousands of registration in the dumpster. How? But that's done under the color of laws, they say.
Yep.
Like, for example, in California, 42% of registration forms were thrown in the dumpster, but supposedly legally on the grounds that they had suspect signatures, whatever that means, suspicious names, whatever that means. I asked, what's a suspicious name? They said, well, like Muhammad. Seriously. They couldn't enter them in the machine. 42% of registration forms, and you know whose those were. It was Hispanic. They said hyphenated names, foreign names, Filipino names, Asian names, Arabic names. Well, come on. That's who was being thrown out in California, 42% of all registration forms that were coming in from voter drives. And that gets us to the ballot, in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, the Greg Palast ballot condom for safe voting is register. You say, well, I am registered. Forget it, Jack, especially in Florida. Maybe you're a felon. Maybe you're crazy. You're not allowed to vote in Florida if you're legally insane unless you're the governor. And so you get you have to check your registration, make sure they have your signature right, your address right, and that they didn't misspell your name. If they misspelled your name and you come in with your ID, well, it doesn't match what they have in the voter rolls. You're going to lose your vote. You better make sure that's straightened out, my friend, and vote early, like right now, in person. You can do that in Florida. Start voting early. And you can do that in every state in America has early voting. Everyone, you can vote early. That's by federal law. They try to knock it down because they want to make it, during the day on a work day so that working people have a tough time getting to the polls, and it gets jammed. And then when you show up at the poll and your name is, you're listed as an illegal voter, or my favorite, like actually made up the ballot bandits, how to beat the ballot bandits poster. He lost his vote. He walked in. They said he was an inactive voter. Now, how do they know he hasn't done his sit-ups? An inactive voter. 9 million people are marked as inactive. Whatever the heck that means. It means you haven't voted enough. Well, you can't now walk in and say, well, okay, I'm voting now. No, you can't. You're marked as inactive. Now, who makes that decision? Who knows? Karl Rove with Data Trust, Coke with their Themis machine. You're on some pimply jackass's BlackBerry who's challenging you. Okay, that's how you lose your vote. And by the way, you get the follow-ups on this at gregpalast.com, gregpalast.com, and with the comics. And, you know, it's so get this book, and at least you can have a laugh while they're burgling the deal, and then protect yourself, man. Take the responsibility for your vote.
Well, not only do I want to mention your 7 ways to beat the ballot bandit section at the end of the book, you've also got an excellent section on action resources and an excellent section on media resources. This is a must-buy. All our good progressives out there, you need to get this book. Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, the incredible Greg Palast, a writer that we all need to be familiar with. Thank you so much, Greg.
Terrific. Thank you for the opportunity and for bringing my words back across the electronic Berlin Wall.
And there's a link on the site to buy that book. This is a book you got to buy. Greg Palast, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Thanks so much, Greg. Hope you feel better.
I thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Greg Palast, political author, economic author, explainer of the American way of elections. A couple more stories I want to get to before the show is over. By the way, I want to thank my co-producer, Mickey Royce, without whose help and assistance these shows couldn't occur. I want to thank our co-sponsors, Imagineering Productions, a full-service multimedia SEO firm, and also Media Goddess Worldwide, a public relations firm that you should be aware of. Please support our sponsors. Sponsorship opportunities are available. By the way, the Shizuoka Assembly has nixed a nuclear referendum. The people wanted to vote. They wanted to be able to vote on whether these people turn on the nuclear power plants again. But the administration of the assembly decided there were several reasons why they didn't want the public to vote on this. Gee, I wonder what that could be. And on our Fukushima front, number one, radioactive tanks are maxed out. This is from AP, written by Mari Yakamaguchi. She says, workers at Fukushima number one plant are struggling to find space to store thousands of tons of highly contaminated water used to cool the crippled reactors, manager of the water treatment team said. About 200,000 tons of radioactive water, enough to fill more than 50 Olympic swimming pools, are being stored in hundreds of gigantic tanks built around the complex. Tokyo Electric Power has already felled trees to make room for more tanks and predicts the volume of water will then triple in 3 years. It's a pressing issue because our land is limited and we would eventually run out of storage space, treatment manager Yuichi Okamura told AP. EPCO is close to starting a new treatment system that could make water safe enough to discharge into the ocean, but its tanks are filling up in the meantime, mostly because cracks in the reactor building are allowing groundwater in. Experts worry that highly reactive water could have a lasting impact on the environment and fear that because the reactor leaks and the water flowing from one part of the facility to another, this is already happening. And I want to close with one more reminder that the show's good friend, Meredith Ackman, she's asking for your support to help her go to the Victory Institute so she can be trained to be a good candidate, a very successful candidate. So please look up Meredith Ackman on Facebook, on YouTube, and sign up. Help her get her elected to go to the Victory Institute. She is a very worthwhile individual. She's a president of Palm Beach Now, vice president of State Now, a woman who's worked all her life for human rights, for women's rights, and for LGBT rights. Make sure you support her. If there's any chance you can, please vote. And as for me, I'll be buried in Chicago so I can continue to vote long after I'm gone. So I want to thank you once again for joining us tonight at Progressive News Network. Remember, it's going to be a better world because you and I are going to work every day to make it so. We only have a country. We only have a democracy when we insist on it. We only have a Bill of Rights when we insist on it. So make sure that you insist on it. Ladies and gentlemen, what are they going to do about us?